sorry, I guess you didn't get my little bio. Okay, I'm actually a doctoral candidate at University of Oxford in International Health and Development. I got my MPH at Tulane in International Health and Development, and I actually worked on this pilot study while I was completing Tulane, and in the month while I was completing Tulane and starting Oxford in medical anthropology last year. So that's when I worked on this. And this is my disclosure statement. I focused mainly on the area of Guatemala in the highlands in the southwest region known as Solala, which you can see in kind of the lower left quadrant of the map there. And I focused on a beautiful area, at least the lake itself is quite beautiful, Lago Atitlan. And that's quite a nice picture of the lake. And I focused on five communities in Lago Atitlan. And my research questions included, what medical pluralism exists in these communities? What are the health care preferences and practices of indigenous Guatemalans in these communities? Are there difference in preference and practices across age, gender, and community? Because I should say, in this particular region, there are 23 indigenous languages throughout Guatemala. In this region, there were three. So each community very much is its own entity. And what factors influence choice of intervention? My main interest was sparked by the World Bank reports and UNDP figures indicating that Guatemala has some of the poorest values on indicators in malnutrition for the region, the poorest values on indicators for health in the Western Hemisphere, second often only to Haiti, and also the lowest amount of funds allocated to public health. So very briefly, I'll just give a quick contextualization of the political history of Guatemala, which was very influenced by a 36-year internal conflict that was mainly directed against the indigenous population. This affected all structural parts of the country, but especially the health of the indigenous people as well. Religion very often affects and has affected since colonialism the types of medical pluralism available, especially in terms of Catholic religion and then the evangelical religion, which replaced it as a primary religion in Guatemala over the last 20 years. The position of the church, especially the evangelical church, is that indigenous Mayan medical systems are basically the work of the devil or a sin. And so very often indigenous members of these parishes will not adhere to their indigenous Mayan systems. Violence and crime has been, for the past 50 years, a common part of Guatemala, especially towards the indigenous community. And even after the peace accords in 1996, there are still roving bands of usually youth gang members that cause great amounts of violence. And communities often take it upon themselves to, especially indigenous communities, to seek justice. The political economy has been affected very much by neoliberal policy, by the World Trade Organization, by NAFTA, and also very much by the multinational corporations such as the United Fruit Company, which controlled the majority of the arable land in Guatemala. This has had a great effect on not only the health of Guatemalans, but the nutrition of indigenous Guatemalans. And the environment is a primary concern, especially around the lake, where you have a huge amount of pesticide use and chemical fertilizers that are now being introduced into agriculture that are running off into the lake. Sea bass, about 2 years ago, was introduced into the lake and has completely altered the ecosystem and the fishing industry in this region. And then you have in the lower right-hand corner here the old American Bluebird buses, that school buses that we got rid of, but they use with no emissions controls for transportation. And health and hygiene is very much a concern. Not only is there low amounts of potable water, and people commonly use water from the lake, which is highly polluted, but as you can see here, there are not a great many standards that are enforced as far as hygiene. Oriana in 1997 defined pre-colonial medicine as including a pluralism of herbology, traditional midwifery, bone setting, steam bath, fumigation, bleeding, and minor surgery, many of which have survived in many communities up until the present. Etiology of illness was seen to be as due to sorcery or was sent by gods as punishment for not adhering to rules and regulations of a certain community. Sacrifice was usually utilized to appease gods. Foster in 1984 posited that humoral medicine was really based on dichotomies such as heat and cold, as is primary in Latin America, was really introduced by colonialism and is not indigenous to indigenous Guatemala. So here you see a list of the various members of the medical team in many different indigenous Guatemalan systems. And I should say that there's not one hegemonic system, that basically every community has its own practices. And you'll see in the northern area of Guatemala, all the way up to Chiapas and the Yucatan in Mexico, Tuk and Jop practitioners, which basically perform a type of acupuncture that actually correlates to about 54 acupuncture points. So in Guatemala, there are no sharply defined roles where, for example, a midwife will only do midwifery, a traditional midwife. You'll see midwives who also practice herbology, who also practice various other indigenous medical systems, such as recommending steam baths. So there's not a sharply defined system or a sharply defined role for each member of the medical team in indigenous communities. So you'll see very often in markets the herbs that are available. And here we have an example of a bone setter. And this is my friend actually not very happy, getting her bone set by this bone setter for what turned out to be a broken ankle. Shamans are very common. The term curandaro, which is prevalent, was actually a colonial term to lump various healers into this, or shamans, into this one category. And so shaman curandaro is a term that's often used in the circle here. You'll all often see the four cardinal directions, and they put various candles and sacrifices, which usually comes in the form of whiskey and Coca-Cola, within this and perform a ceremony. And they often use smoke, not only to get themselves in a different state from a cigar, but also to blow on the patient to try to heal them. So my methodology was I used 50 indigenous informants to find my free list, to assemble a free list. The data was analyzed with ethnograph, and 21 of the most salient terms were listed on index cards written in Spanish and Cachical. And from these terms, 50 pile sorts were performed. The pile sorts were analyzed using SPSS and Johnson's hierarchical cluster analysis. And both the free list and the pile sorts informed a short survey with a five-point Likert scale regarding how often and for what illnesses was natural medicine, biomedicine, and acupuncture used, and one open-ended question regarding what type of treatment was the preference for treating illness. Surveys were read aloud to informants in Spanish, and Cachical was used when a translator was available. Surveys were analyzed with proportional analysis and SPSS. So this is just an overview of my methodology. Everything was conducted with random sampling and usually by word of mouth, except my semi-structured interviews, which I focused on specific members of the community. My design was I had a total sample of 210 people. I did collect informed consent. There were few identifiers that I used beyond age and sex and community. Data was safeguarded confidentially. Confidentiality was upheld, and I received IRB approval from Tulane University. So, in analyzing my free lists, my question to informants was, what do you do and whom do you go to when you or someone in your family is sick? I also asked, what words do you think of when I say healing or health? And I questioned 38 females and 12 males randomly. 54% mentioned using non-biomedicine treatments or interventions, and 46% mentioned using solely biomedicine. Out of a possible 22, 12 use non-biomedicine for fevers. Out of 13, 7 informants use non-biomedicine for cough. And out of a possible 26, 20 informants reported using non-biomedicine for stomach pathology. And of 7 questioned, all 7 mentioned for serious illness that they use biomedicine. So these were terms from the free list that I came up with my 21 pile sort cards. They're basically in Spanish. They were also translated into Kachikal. And I'm not going to analyze them in interest of time. In a proportional analysis of my surveys, males under 30 years of age, this is incorrect, I saw this morning, 61% preferred biomedicine of males under 31 years of age, and 75% primarily used biomedicine. Of men over 30, 71% preferred using herbs, and 54% primarily used these interventions. 66% of women under 30 preferred natural medicine or herbs, and 58% used biomedicine for interventions. 56% of women older than 30 preferred use of natural medicine and herbs, but 62% of these women actually practiced by using biomedicine, and there was no significant difference found across the communities. So why is it that younger women and older men, I found, granted in a sample of approximately 110, preferred utilizing non-biomedicine for their interventions and practiced that as well? Well, Wilson understood in the tribe known as the Ketchke a comparison of corn and the body, so that if you're harming agriculturally the corn by using fertilizers, etc., the idea was that you could be harming the body as well by using these very strong biomedical interventions. So this would be especially true to women in their reproductive years and elderly patients. Access and affordability is also a very important consideration. The function of many of the medicinal plants are very commonly known in communities, and each community has their own indigenous plants that are grown and has passed down from generation to generation. They can be found in abundance within the community, and they're cost-effective because they usually cost absolutely nothing. So, but there are some other factors that come into play in general in medical systems that affect medical pluralism. Lane devised a prediction model in which he stated that people prioritize the available medical alternatives based on their perception of the probability that each offers for a cure. Now, I didn't go into this, but basically when I informally interviewed people, I was told basically that they will seek a cure depending on what the illness is. They will seek several at the same time. So they may go to an herbalist, they may go to a biomedical doctor, they may go to their parent for a recommendation for an herbal remedy. And they may not use a shaman, for example, until much later. In this pilot study, I found that the severity of illness and the need for rapid recovery were the primary reasons in the treatment of a choice for an acute illness. And this is basically referring to biomedicine. If they wanted a quick recovery from dolor de estómago, pain in the stomach, or dolor de cabeza, then they would primarily use biomedicine. Lip also understands a very simple formula that can be applied to these communities. When a family member becomes ill, household remedies are initially used, particularly if the illness is relatively benign. These include the use of patent medicines, medicinal plants, fright illness rituals, massage, sweat baths. If after that no relief is obtained, then they will see the shaman cure, because this is thought to be almost of a higher plane of illness. So part of the issues that could be looked at with my results from this study could come from the sample size. 210 is not an enormous sample size, but it's no small sample size for primarily ethnographic data, and so it could be that the sample size was not large enough. There was a problem definitely in interviewing non-Spanish speakers, and that means I probably was not interviewing the poorest members of the community, because usually the Spanish speakers would be a higher educational level and a higher socioeconomic level. So that could have presented a problem that I was not really getting a representative sample. More in-depth interviews with indigenous population could definitely have been used. And an environmental analysis of what was available, not only in the community as far as the herbs go, but what was available in the various pharmacies. What did the pharmacy stock? What did the pharmacy sell the most? I did not use that in this study, and I could have. Participant observation could have been utilized much more. My implications from this pilot study are that medical systems need to be understood as changing systems, that all we really get in a study like this is a photograph of a given part of the community at a given time. And by virtue of the various factors that I mentioned in the beginning, these will all change. For example, oil now is a huge problem in Guatemala and has affected the cost of everything, including especially transportation, but especially foods and pharmaceuticals as well. So this will affect, over time, what the community utilizes. Community preferences, practices, and perceptions of illness and treatment as a result of cosmology, culture, and community, municipal, and global structural forces. And I came back from Guatemala about a week ago after a six-week Royal Geographic Society-funded research expedition looking at nutrition, and I found this was particularly true of nutrition as well. Traditional complementary medicine really needs to be considered a part of, rather than apart from, public health interventions. If we're really going to interact with indigenous communities, we can't just come in with a top-down structure successfully and tell the community what they should be doing. We need to listen to the community and make the community a part of the intervention, and make the community's interventions a part of our interventions as well, in order to really establish success. This is a model that I devised, which is, I'm not going to go into any detail, but for the nutritional analysis that I just did, and all I want to show you here is that the same can be utilized in describing medical systems. Globalization as this outermost level, what the NGOs are doing and how they interact not only with one another but with the municipality and with the community, what the municipality and government is doing. Are they providing the interventions that they're getting funding for, or is there a great amount of corruption and the funding is never getting to the community? And also, what are the practices, preferences, and perceptions of the community, which is what this pilot study was about. And this is another overview of all the forces that I determined that are in many ways affecting the changing medical system in indigenous Guatemala. So next steps that could be utilized if this study were continued are algorithms of pluralism, depicting what healers are employed and at what juncture, more in-depth interviews, especially of the indigenous community, in order to determine the structures underlying various healing systems, and to determine how traditional and complementary and alternative medicine can address health disparity, not only in this community, in this country, but also in all indigenous and developing communities. And I'd like to acknowledge these professors, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Paul. We're close to running out of time, but I do want to save some time for questions for the panelists. If you have any questions, please stand up, state your name, and address our speakers. Please.